that were written with Amit Givan from Jerusalem. And there's quite a lot to say, so I will be a little bit schematic on much of it. And so let me sort of to put you in the mood, tell you some background material for this. Well, of course, the subject of supersymmetric gauge theories is pretty well understood. People worked on it for a long time, and there are some very powerful techniques available to study the supersymmetric vacuum. Things like the NSVZ beta function, non-perturbative superpotential, Zeiberg duality, A maximization. When we are faced with a supersymmetric theory, we can throw all this stuff at it, and in many cases understand the dynamics. And spontaneous supersymmetry breaking, which was sort of the thing that is most important to actual nature about the subject, was also studied for a long time, but it was thought for a long time to be a very esoteric phenomenon, not exhibited by some random supersymmetric theory that you might write down. And this attitude that was prevalent for a long time started to change when Intrilligator, Zeiberg, and Shi found a metastable supersymmetry breaking vacuum in sort of the most elementary supersymmetric system that had been studied for a long time, supersymmetric QCD, with only a small mass for the quarks being added to the sort of most trivial definition of the theorem. And that led people to begin suspecting that there is actually a lot more to be learned about non-supersymmetric metastable states in supersymmetric gauge theories. It was not believed before that there is an interesting landscape of sort of non-supersymmetric minima in these theories. But in fact, one of the two main purposes of this talk, and what I will spend the first part of it on, is to show you that a small deformation of supersymmetric QCD leads precisely to such a structure, to a very sort of rich landscape of the energy function with a lot of local minima, which can be made arbitrarily long-lived by tuning parameters. And there is a direction in which I will not go, which is to try to understand the relation between such models and nature. But of course, that's something that there's a lot to say about as well. The second part of this talk involves something that actually was the main focus of this project, but it will, I'll spend very little time on at the end, and for reasons that will become clear. And that is how to embed these gauge theories and this vacuum structure that we're going to find in the gauge theory, in string theory. Now, this is again a subject that has been studied for the last 10 years. We can realize interesting gauge theories as low energy theories on various brains. And in fact, for the supersymmetric cases, a lot has been learned from these embeddings, such as geometric realizations of interesting gauge theory phenomena, such as Zeiberg-Witten curves, Zeiberg duality, etc. But again, until recently, the attitude to this was the following, that in order to understand what these brains are doing, you have to be in a regime in the parameter space, the sort of geometric parameter space that we will discuss, which is different from the one in which the gauge theory is valid. And in the old days, say 10 years ago, people mainly were interested in protected quantities, things related to the vacuum manifold. And that's not a big deal if you have to continuously change some parameters by a lot to, in going from the gauge theory regime to the brain regime. You expect still the qualitative features to be the same. But of course, the same cannot be said about sensitive things like the existence of metastable states in the landscape of the energy. And the second point of this talk is actually going to be that the brain constructions not only exhibit exactly the same structure of metastable states as the gauge theory, but in fact, they provide a much simpler realization of it. We will see that in the gauge theory, to understand these metastable states requires all sorts of complicated algebraic calculations. Whereas at least once you become comfortable with these brain pictures, you can understand pretty well how the vacuum structure looks, including those metastable states, which again, a priori could have changed by a lot in going from the gauge theory regime to the string theory one. And of course, whenever we embed a problem in string theory, there is an added bonus that we can do quantitative calculations in a different regime, in the string theory regime where gauge theory is not valid. So that's what I'm planning to do. And so let me go ahead and start talking about the actual system that we will study. As I mentioned, we're going to take the simplest theory out there, which is supersymmetric QCD with gauge group SUNC and the number of flavors that is such that there is a vacuum to this thing. And we're not going to do anything particular with these numbers in F and C. They are of order one. We will have NF flavors of these fundamentals, chiral superfields. And as I said before, this theory is pretty well understood. It's asymptotically free when the number of flavors is smaller than 3 times the number of colors. But we will actually take it most of the time to a regime in which it's very asymptotically free. And in fact, it's strongly coupled in the infrared. And there is a better description of it in terms of the Zeibrugge dual. So I'm assuming everybody's familiar with this. I'm just essentially setting up notation here. The Zeibrugge dual, the magnetic theory, dual to this supersymmetric QCD, has a different gauge group, a different set of fundamentals, and in addition has some gauge singlets, which are the images in the magnetic theory of the mesons of the electric theory. And it has a non-trivial superpotential that couples those things together, which is cubic. Lambda here is some scale that is pretty well understood, but I will not talk about too much. Now, what we're actually going to study is a theory in which we turned on already in the electric, the original SUNC description, a non-trivial superpotential, which will have two terms. One, a mass term for the quarks, which is like what was done in that ISS paper that I mentioned before. But in addition, we will add a small quartic term in the quarks. And one of the many reasons to do this is that if you omit this term, this theory has a certain R symmetry, a symmetry under which the meson field has R charge too. And this accidental symmetry is detrimental to various uses of this theory for supersymmetry breaking. So this is the simplest thing you can write down in supersymmetric QCD that has a mass scale and breaks our symmetry. Now, under Zeibrugge duality, this is of course mapped to a system in which, in addition to the original superpotential that I wrote before, there are these two terms, which I just copy from here. And what that means is that if you integrate out the massive field M from this Lagrangian, this magnetic description gives also a quartic and quadratic term in the magnetic quarks. And so it's very similar to what it looks like in the electric variables. So that implies that for many purposes, we can do all sorts of calculations that I will briefly describe in either the electric or the magnetic variables. And we will do them in the magnetic variables for the reasons that I mentioned before. Now, actually, when we realize that we're interested in this theory, we try to find at least the supersymmetric vacuum structure of this problem in the literature. And it turned out that even that has not been done. And it's kind of interesting. So I will spend a few minutes talking about that. In other words, what I'm going to do is study this magnetic theory with this superpotential and look for vacuum. Now, it turns out, supersymmetric vacuum at first. It turns out that there are two types of vacuum. This should not be clear from anything I said here, but you can look at the details in our paper. the mesonic branch in which this M matrix, the singlet meson matrix, is non-singular. And then there is a baryonic branch in which it is singular, and there's a non-trivial expectation value for the baryon constructed out of these little cues. I will only discuss here the mesonic branch. The other one is very simple to understand too, but we will not need it. And in the mesonic branch, as far as the gauge dynamics is concerned, the fact that this matrix is non-degenerate means that the quarks are massive and we can integrate them out. So we do that. And what we find is the original three-level superpotential, and then the usual non-perturbative contribution to the superpotential that has to do with the mass matrix of the massive magnetic quarks, where here this lambda e is again some scale that appears naturally in the problem and I will not discuss. So this, if you're interested in the supersymmetric vacua, is all you need to know about this problem. You have to find solutions to the F-term equations, which are written here. And of course, divide by global symmetries and solve the D-term conditions as well. I will not do this in detail, but you can imagine doing it. And what you find is that once you take the D-term conditions into account, this M can be written as a diagonal matrix. And because of the quadratic matrix equation that it satisfies, this quadratic in M is proportional to the identity matrix, it can only have two distinct eigenvalues, which I will denote by X and Y. And vacua are labeled by the degeneracies of these eigenvalues. So if X appears nf minus k times and Y appears k times, you can check that these F-term equations give rise to these two algebraic constraints on X and Y. And so we see that supersymmetric vacua are labeled by this parameter k here. So these constraints, of course, since they're just polynomial equations, they're easy to solve. But again, I will not describe the details here. I will just say that the details are slightly different in the case where the number of flavors is smaller than twice the number of colors and when it's equal. Remember, here we can do this for any NF and NC in either the electric or the magnetic language because it's all supersymmetric stuff. And what you find is that in this regime, there are this many isolated vacua. By isolated vacua, I mean that everything is massive in them. And in the other regime of the number of flavors, the number of isolated vacua is slightly different. And of course, you can understand the pattern of global symmetries in this different vacuum, but I will not spend time on it here. Now, these vacua actually are not all small deformations of classical ones. After all, one way you could have proceeded is just first eliminating this term, finding the vacua of just the classical superpotential, and then hoping for the best, that this will only deform them slightly. But in fact, it turns out that not all vacua are like this. Some of them are indeed small deformations of classical vacua, while others come in from infinity when the non-perturbative superpotential is turned on. And moreover, you can check, and this is a sort of a non-trivial check of Zeiberg duality, that doing this analysis in the electric and the magnetic language gives rise to precisely the same vacuum structure, and you can calculate the expectation values of various gauge invariant chiral fields in the two descriptions and find that they're equal. So that's the story of the supersymmetric vacua. They're labeled by these parameters, and they have the degeneracies I wrote there. But in fact, it turns out that there is a lot more that is not captured by the supersymmetric analysis. And that's what I will discuss next. There are many metastable vacua in the energy landscape of this model. And in order to exhibit them, as I mentioned before, we will go to a regime in which this magnetic description that I've been using is actually free in the infrared. And so we can neglect the SUNF minus NC gauge interactions and just study it as a Wesumina model for the chiral superfields. In order to do it in detail, we also need to rescale this meson field M by some factor and define the rescale meson phi, which has a canonically normalized kinetic term or Keller potential. And so the problem then is specified in the following way. We have just the chiral superfields phi and q. They have standard kinetic terms, at least near the origin of field space, and they have this kind of superpotential, where now, again, because all the fields are canonically normalized, this H is dimensionless, it's a Yukawa coupling, and then we have two mass parameters, mu and mu phi, which are related to those M and alpha from before. So mu is related to this M, and mu phi is related to alpha by some constant rescaling. And so this is the problem that we need to study. No gauge interactions, just the Wesumina model with these interactions. And moreover, we will take these parameters, namely the Yukawa coupling, and the ratio of the two scales, the ratio of the quadratic term to the linear one, to be very small, and will work to leading order in these parameters. And this is what will be responsible for the fact that these vacua that we're going to find are going to be arbitrarily long-lived. They become.
One of them is related to this dimensionful parameter and the superpotential, and the other one is related to the lambda scale, right?
Well, so we started the where was it? So we started with this picture here, and M here, because it was equal to Q tilde Q, was naturally sort of dimension two of it. So we rescaled it by some factor to get phi here, and then the coefficient here just became a dimensionless parameter that they called H. And then here, this became a term that is linear in phi, so its coefficient has dimension two, and that is the sort of mu squared term. And the mu phi came from here, so I could write for you the exact relations between these alpha and lambda and the parameters mu and mu phi. But really, it doesn't matter. You know, you can parameterize the.
What I'm asking is in this IISS model, the condition was that M has to be basically less than lambda, roughly.
Well, yeah, so.
I'm asking if there is a similar condition.
There is a similar condition here, but it's actually not going to be of much interest to us because what happens when you turn on this deformation, which was absent in the ISS model because of the fact that you break up symmetry, already classically, this model has supersymmetric vacuum, right? It is directly related to the fact that we broke out symmetry. In ISS, the analog of this did not have supersymmetric vacua. And the reason there even were supersymmetric vacua was that because of the SUNF minus NC dynamics, right? There was a non-perturbative contribution that had to do with that lambda you're talking about, the scale of the magnetic theory that brought back some supersymmetric vacuum from infinity. Here we don't need that. If you wish, I can take the scale of the SUNF minus NC gauge theory to infinity in energy and think of it as much, much larger than all these scales, arbitrarily so. The analog of the small parameter that ISS relies on will play no role here. the small parameter, the analog of the small parameter here is going to be precisely the ratio between this mu phi and mu. In fact, you will see it very explicitly in a moment. In a little while. In what sense precisely this ratio between mu phi and mu plays the role of that epsilon? You might be familiar with the work. Okay, but the thing I wanted to remember for now is just that these parameters are very small.
Now, actually, so it looks like a sort of elementary problem. We have a bunch of free fields. We have a very simple looking superpotential. Find the local minima of the super of the bosonic potential. But in fact, it's a pretty messy problem. There are matrices. There are all sorts of indices running around here. And we actually honestly found the solutions for the local minima by starting from the string theory problem that I will describe a little bit later on. But once you understand what's going on, a way to do this in the field theory directly is the following. You take these fields that we have, the adjoint of the flavor group and the quarks, and you parameterize them in this way here, where some of the components, a sort of k by k matrix of quarks, have expectation values. So that means that SUNF minus NC is broken in any case to SUNF minus NC minus k by the expectation values of those quarks. And similarly, this phi field has an expectation value that goes like this in some other block of the matrix. And it turns out that the light fields that you should be keeping track of are just these other two blocks in these matrices. And by the way, this also already sort of goes partly towards answering your question about the small parameters. You see, where did this mu squared over mu phi come from? It came from requiring that the potential for phi vanish. The expectation value of phi that comes from this term is mu squared over mu phi. And, or more precisely, of h phi. And so this basically is saying that the F term conditions are satisfied for this block of phi. So the supersymmetric vacua here have expectation value that become large as mu phi goes to zero. And this is the analog of the statement in the ISS model that in the supersymmetric vacuum, the expectation values of this phi become large because of the largeness of this lambda m. So you see that the analog of this small parameter here is essentially mu phi over mu. But I'll say it a little bit better later on. Anyway, so there is some algebraic problem that I don't want to spend too much time on. You parameterize these fields in this way. So here, again, just to make sure we're on the same page, this phi n is by definition an n by n matrix, whereas these phi and phi tilde over there, these guys are matrices of this size. And the supersymmetric vacua, as I mentioned before, correspond, for example, to taking this h phi n to be proportional to the identity matrix with the same proportionality constant like here, and taking these components of the chiral superfield in the fundamental to be zero. But those expectation values are large. So the expectation value of the adjoint field is large in units of this mu. Again, just like in the ISS model, where it has to do with the magnetic gauge theory, non-perturbative superpotential. And again, classically, if you just look at the F-term conditions, there are no additional vacuum here. But it turns out that if you include one-loop corrections to the potential, new vacua appear near the origin of field space, and those are the ones that I want to study, vacua in which the expectation value of this guy is not large,
and this is small as well. And they're not supersymmetric, but they might be stable or metastable. So you write the potential, including the classical terms that come from this superpotential here, as well as the one loop contribution, which is the quadratic in phi n with the coefficient that was actually computed in that paper I mentioned. And you study the energy landscape of this. So you see what happens here is if you're looking for a solution in which phi n is non-zero, then phi and phi tilde have to be zero. But there is a linear term in the potential for phi n from the classical potential, which drives it away from the origin. And then there is a restoring quadratic term from the one loop. And so there is a non-trivial minimum in which these two sort of balance against each other. And you can calculate where that minimum is. It is at some value of this adjoint field, which is proportional to the small number mu phi. So, so this is the picture that you get. There is a supersymmetric vacuum at some value which is very large in units of this mu. And there is a non-supersymmetric but locally stable minimum at a very small value of this phi. And so it's clearly stable in the direction of fluctuations of this phi field, the adjoint phi n. But when you look at the fluctuations of the fundamental phi and phi tilde, you get that for very small coefficient mu phi, there are actually tachyons in the spectrum. And so you have to require that this condition is satisfied in order for small fluctuations in the directions of these phis are stable as well. And so when all the dust settles, you have these kinds of solutions in general, where mu phi has some lower bound on it, and the solution is near the origin. So phi and phi tilde are zero, and this phi n field is very small. And the vacuum energy of this is given by this thing here. And in particular, it's not zero. This is clearly a non-supersymmetric vacuum. Now, when you look at the stability analysis of it to look at the lifetime, there are actually two types of instabilities. One is that you can tunnel in the direction of increasing phi n towards the supersymmetric minimum. And the other is tunneling in the direction of these phis getting an expectation value, which takes you to some other supersymmetric minimum. And these tunneling rates can be made parametrically small by tuning these parameters that I mentioned here. And in the limit where these parameters become arbitrarily small, the tunneling rate goes to zero, so the lifetime of these states becomes larger and larger. And moreover, because these phi fields that appeared in this decomposition have this kind of size, then for some particular values of this k here, they don't exist at all, and so such vacua are more stable. So, you know, there is a, I'm not trying to have you follow the algebra here, but the main message is that there is some well-defined sort of algebraic calculation that you can do. It leads to these vacua that you can make parametrically long-lived. And so the bottom line is that there are a lot of metastable supersymmetry-breaking vacua in addition to the supersymmetric ones that I described a little earlier on. And moreover, the metastable vacua, in some sense, they're more of because they're labeled by these two integers, k and n, that sort of separately run from 1 up to an f or nc or some combination of them. And so for large nf and nc, the number of these solutions is large. And some of them are sort of more stable, some of them are less stable, but you know, depending on the parameters, they come in and go away just like you would expect in a sort of system with different parameters like this. Now, of course, you know, you could just have written some complicated Wes-Domino potential and studied it without any embedding in any kind of gauge theory and have gotten a similar structure. But I think the reason that such things are interesting for sort of applications to nature is that we do expect the dynamics to be simple at some level. And so the fact that this particular class of Wes-Domino models is realized naturally in some rather simple gauge theories is interesting, and you know, they might have phenomenological applications. Not this gauge dynamic necessarily. You want to have something of this sort as a hidden sector, and then you want, say, part of the global symmetry group of this to play the role of standard model gauge groups, etc. So, you know, I'm not discussing here the infinite number of options of using such things for phenomenology. No, but my own view on this part of it is that all you can hope for at the present state of knowledge is just to provide mechanisms for how things could work. You are never going to guess how the real world works without knowing the experimental facts about it. So I'm most certainly not trying to say that I have a viable model that starts with this as a hidden sector and couples it via some particular mediation mechanism to whatever. I was simply trying to point out the point I was trying to make just now was that I find it interesting that you write, you saw what I started with, a very simple gauge theory with a very simple superpotential. The simplest thing one could write that satisfies the constraint I mentioned, that there's a mass scale and our symmetry is broken. And this leads to this kind of structure in the infrared. And, you know, there's a lot of room here for interesting effects. That was the main point. If you want to directly write something very complicated, that of course is entirely up to you, but I think this is, I mean, it's more appealing to get such non-trivial structures from simple theories. Yes,
so you get your metastable vacuo only when you included one loop
correction.
So is there a simple way to, so those vacuo were absent?
Right, classically, that's right.
Classically, so where do they come from? Is there some field that gets, is being brought from infinity in the, and I guess, so, and so that's my first question. And second one, how are, so this is just a one loop result. So
yes.
How are we sure that those vacuum will not disappear
after, you two loop.
After we go to two loop, because here you are balancing your classical.
Yeah, so, well, so the second question is simpler. The situation here is very similar to what you are very familiar with in things like the epsilon expansion, right? So if you have, say, in Banks-Zaks theories, if you are trying to look for a zero of the beta function, and the leading term in the beta function is very small, and all the rest of the terms in the beta function are sort of naturally of order one, right? There's no reason for them to be smaller. Like, you're just tuning the leading term. That's what you're doing, say, when you're taking, you know, in actual Banks and Zaks, the number of layers to 11 halves the number of colors. And then if you find a minimum near the origin, not a minimum, in that case, you know, a new fixed point near the origin in which the very small one loop term balances against the order one two loop term, then automatically the higher terms are small because they have coefficients of order one and they're down by powers of the coupling, right? Mm-hmm. That's what happens in general in the epsilon expansion. And this is what happens here as well. So if you ask, what is this, basically what you were asking me just now is what is the small parameter that is the analog of that small coefficient in front of the one loop? And that's, the answer is here, you see. So forget about this term, that's zero. So the linear term, what are you doing? You're balancing the linear term in phi n that comes from here with the quadratic term that comes from here. So the linear term is small because mu phi is small. That's the analog of this 11/2 and c minus n f, whatever, and being small in that problem, or in Wilson, in the original epsilon expansion, the coefficient of the classical dimension of the phi to the four interaction in the informant epsilon dimension. So this is an unnaturally small. And all these, the higher term, the two loop you were talking about, etc., they're all finite in the limit mu phi goes to zero, right? So that's the answer to your question, that I'm balancing, just like there, the one loop, here the classical with the one loop, and there's no hope that the higher terms will make any difference because they're all finite in the limit mu phi goes to zero. Just like there, the higher terms in the beta function are all finite in the limit where dimension goes to 4 and Wilson, or when the f goes to 11/2 and c in Banksack, etc. So that's the answer to that one. And remind me, the other one was what?
Where does the vacuum come from?
Where we come from? Well, so you see what happens here is that, so you know, it's slightly different than in this ISS business, but it's almost the same. So in ISS, classically, you had a flat manifold for the analog of this phi n. Mm-hmm. And the exercise was to show that the one loop raises it this way, right?
Right.
Here, to leading order, classically, you had a very, very slowly rolling linear potential mm-hmm. for phi n, and the quadratic just raised it. So it, I don't know, I would say it's, again, it's like in all these other examples I mentioned. It doesn't come from infinity. It's, you know, it's like asking in Wilson's phi to the four work, where does the new minimum, new zero of the beta function come from when the dimension is not 4, but 4 minus epsilon? I don't know. Come. Okay, so, yeah, but you know, there's some algebra here. It's messy, as you see. I sort of put a little bit of it here just to give you some feeling for how messy it is. Yeah, so you have a very diverse structure here. You have different vacua with different patterns of global symmetries. You can use different parts of that global symmetry for the standard model gauge group, etc. But as I said, we're not going to go there. What we're going to do is talk about embedding this story in string theory instead, unless there are any other comments or questions about this gauge theory part. Yeah.
Yeah, the tachyons that you mentioned, that simply means if in the previous life, if that last condition is not fulfilled, it only means that new vacua open up, right? Because a symmetry gets broken because the one loop superpotential seems perfectly reasonable.
So if this condition is not satisfied,
yeah, you mentioned that.
That means that the vacuum. So you know, I found this solution. So this is minimum of this energy function in the sort of phi n direction.
Right.
But if this condition is not satisfied, then it's a saddle point. So the minimum in the phi n direction has this unstable direction in the direction of this little phi.
Which means that new vacuum would open up.
Yes, but we know what those are. So if this condition is not satisfied and you start with one of those, it will just take you back to one of the vacuum in which this phi has an expectation value, and it's basically a supersymmetric vacuum with a different value of parameter k. In other words, this expectation value phi phi tilde will then run to this, to mu squared times unit matrix in the direction, in n by n unit matrix, and then you would just interpret it as a supersymmetric. One of the supersymmetric vacua that you already know about. So we yes, what you say is right, and we can track this running from the saddle point all the way to the supersymmetric vacuum in that case. But what I sort of find it interesting that as you change the parameters, it's completely non-apparent in the original description of the model that as you're going to tune these parameters, all of this is going to be going on. That they're going to be these kinds of vacuum, and then you change this new phi a little bit, and then they destabilize, but some of them still remain there. The ones with NF minus NC minus K equals 0. So there's a pretty rich structure here, which also depends on the parameters. Okay, so for the rest of the time, I want to talk a little bit about the string embedding of this. And you know, from my point of view, the main reason to ask about this string embedding is that if we believe that string theory is really realized in nature, there is some advantage to models, say models of supersymmetry breaking that are naturally embedded in string theory over models that are very difficult to embed in this theory. And so I'll explain how to do that in the rest of the talk. There are actually two ways of doing it. One is to study D-brains near conical singularities of Calabi-Yau manifolds. And the second is in studying D-brains that propagate near some of the Schwarz 5 brains. And these are not even completely unrelated. They can be mapped into each other by some version of T-duality, but it's not really going to be important for me. I will actually use the NS 5 brain picture here. And the initial reason we did this was that in the supersymmetric case, it was actually found to be more transparent and more useful than the Calabi-Yau one. But it turned out that it's also the case here. In other words, when you study this metastable vacua, even as we speak, there are certain aspects of the picture that are well understood using these Schwarz 5 brain constructions and that are not understood in the other language. Although, in principle, they should be understandable there because of this T-duality relation I just mentioned. So for this, I mainly have to review some old work on realizations of supersymmetric QCD on these brain constructions. And then the metastable stuff is going to be like very simple to understand in that language. So most of the time I will spend on reviewing some 10-year-old work. And this will involve two kinds of Schwarz 5 brains. We will give them these names, NS and NS prime brains. And we will also have some D brains, D4 brains and D6 brains that will complete the lineup. So the way these brains are going to be arranged is, of course, 3+1 dimensions will have to be common to all the brains. After all, we're interested in realizing 3+1 dimensional Poincaré invariant dynamics on them. And then the NS brains will further be stretched in these two directions, the NS prime brains in these two directions, then the D4 brains in just X6, and the D6 brains in these directions here. And you can actually check, even without knowing anything in addition to this, that any configuration of this sort, where the brains are pointing in these directions, does preserve n equal 1 supersymmetry in 3+1 dimensions. Now, in order to get this n equal 1 supersymmetric QCD from this setup, we have to do the following. So here I also introduced the notation just for brevity, where x4 together with x5 make some complex coordinate v. Say here, x8 and x9 make w, and x6 I'm calling y. And each of these configurations I'm drawing twice because there's a lot going on in these pictures. And so it's useful both to think about the projection of these brain pictures on the 4, 5, 8, 9 plane, where the x6 direction is coming out of the board, and also to think about what happens along x6. Like what is the ordering of the brains in this language in the direction coming out of the board. And so, for example, here we have a situation where from this point of view, the D6 brains are over here someplace. And then the next guy is the NS brain and the NS prime brains are pointing along the W axis as well behind the plane of the board somewhere. That's the message of these two pictures. And then we have some D4 brains, and C of them stretched between the NS and NS prime brains, and NF of them stretched between the NS and D6 brains. So again, this is all sort of 10 years old, and it's pretty well understood. So the way the low energy physics here works is that if you look at fundamental strings that stretch between these D4 brains, you can easily convince yourself that they only give rise to an UNC gauge field and gauge genome. These don't give any massless modes at all. And strings that go from here to here give those electric quarks, the capital Qs and Q tildes, which are the fundamentals. So there are NF of them in this brain configuration. The gauge coupling is, again, something that you can easily compute from here. In 5 dimensions on D4 brains, of course, the gauge coupling is just proportional to G string. And since we have a D4 brain, which is a line segment of a certain length, we can just use the Kaluza-Klein prescription. So the 4-dimensional Young-Mills coupling squared is the G-string divided by the length of these D4 brains in string units. I guess here there's an L-string as well. So that's the gauge coupling. And the moduli space of n equal 1 supersymmetric QCD, the fact that the quarks capital Q can get expectation values, has a pretty simple geometric interpretation here as well by reconnecting these D4 brains with these ones and just moving them sort of out of the plane of the board along the D6 and NS prime brains. So this is how these brain pictures reproduce n equal to 1 supersymmetric QCD. And what we will actually need is the analogous picture for the Zeiberg dual or magnetic brain configuration. And these two are really just related by exchanging the NS and NS prime brains, as you can see from here. So the magnetic configuration is related to the electric one by exchanging these two kinds of brains, and of course, NC by NF minus NC. And as I mentioned in the beginning of this talk, the brain picture helps understand how to go sort of smoothly from here to here. And again, the same sort of comments can be made here. We get the gauge bosons and the gauge genus from 4-4 strings going here. The magnetic meson field now is non-trivial. It comes from this string, and the magnetic quarks correspond to strings like that. So this is just the magnetic brain configuration. And then we need to understand the deformation. After all, in the gauge theory, so far I just told you how to reproduce the theory with this kind of superpotential, but we were interested in adding those two terms to the superpotential. And that corresponds to, it turns out, to a relative translation and rotation of the brains in the picture. Again, it's very easy to understand, but I guess I'm running low on time, so I'll not spend much time on it. So what we do is we start with this picture here, and we move the D6 brain somewhere in the 4-5 direction, and then we rotate it like this. And so we arrive at a picture like this, where I also did another step here, and that is to sort of redistribute all the brains that originally sat here into different groups. So you can convince yourself that if you do this continuously, if you start with this configuration and go to this one, the brains have sort of a choice where to sit, and they can just redistribute themselves in a way like this, where some of them are stretched between the D6 brains and the NS prime brain going along X6. Some other ones are stretched between the D6 brains and the NS brains, and some that remain here. And remember, because these guys are the ones that give us the gauge bosons, the unbroken gauge group corresponding to such a configuration is U and F minus NC minus K. So in fact, it's precisely the picture in terms of brains that corresponds to those supersymmetric vacuum that I was talking about in the gauge theory before. So this provides a very simple parametrization of the supersymmetric vacuum of this deformed theory with the alpha and M turned on. I mean, as I mentioned, alpha and M are just some functions of the geometric parameters of the angle and the separation here. So this is a description of the supersymmetric vacuum. But what is interesting about this picture is that once you got comfortable with this, it becomes trivial how to describe the supersymmetric vacuum. And so the picture with the supersymmetric vacuum, that picture that in the gauge theory looked very contrived, this one where we split these matrices in this weird way and then study the one loop potential for them and find these expectation values. In terms of the brain picture, it's something very, very simple. So remember that the way it works here is that the D6 brains are over here, the NS prime brains are going up and between the D6 brains and the NS brains, which are, say, on the plane of the board. So you can take some of these D4 brains that are running like this here, and you can pull them down towards this intersection here of the where the NS brain is. Now, superficially, it looks like that's a bad idea because it's going to cost you energy, because instead of just going straight like this, they will have to go sort of sideways. And indeed, it will cost you energy, but where you're gaining is that these objects are also attracted by gravitationally to the Nevers-Schwartz brain. And so you can imagine a process where they sit sort of close to here and are locally stable because of a balance of these two forces. The force that wants them to move back there just because of their tension and the fact that they want to be shorter, and the force that pulls them towards the NS brains because of the gravitational attraction of the D brains to the NS brain. And of course, from this point of view, it's very natural that if the angle theta here is very small, which is the same as saying that this alpha parameter is very small, there will be a stable, locally stable equilibrium in which the D4 brains stay like this. And indeed, when you do this calculation, you find that there is such a solution. And okay, and this is what corresponds to that complicated algebraic problem that I outlined in the beginning of this talk. Now, when I talked about the gauge theory, I said that we had two types of instabilities there corresponding to motions in the phi n direction and phi, the fundamental directions. And this is very simple to understand in this picture as well. There are, in the geometric description, also two types of instabilities. So one has to do with some reconnection of the D4 brain. It's easiest to see in this picture. So if we have some brains that are stretched this way between the NS prime and the NS brain, and then we get these guys as well, we can always take the endpoint of this one down here. That increases the energy by a little bit. That's the bad news. But the good news is that once they reconnect, they can snap and move back to here, where their energy is lower. And so one of the directions of instability is just this. You increase the energy a little bit, and then you decrease it by a lot as this together with this moves there. And of course, the second direction of instability is to overcome the gravitational potential of the NS brain and just move back to where these guys came from in the first place. And that is the brain description of the mode of instability that I mentioned in the gauge theory before. So that's what's happening in general. And just like in the gauge theory description, if there is nothing here to reconnect with, then one of the modes of instability that he talked about is just not there. So the only thing that these brains can do is just overcome their potential and move to larger W back here. So that's why the metastable vacua with this condition satisfied are more stable. And of course, if you fix the geometric parameters at any particular value and send your string to zero, all these brain configurations freeze. They become more and more stable in this limit, in fact, exponentially so. So these are actually metastable configurations of brains in the weak string coupling limit. All the elements of the gauge theory discussion that we had before have direct analogs in the brain construction. So I already mentioned these light fundamentals, phi and phi tilde, which correspond to just these fundamental strings that go between these deep brains and these ones, and can get an expectation value by overcoming some potential barrier. More interestingly, the one loop effect that stabilized the metastable states in the gauge theory, in this case, are replaced by this gravitational attraction that I mentioned, which is a classical effect. So one loop effect in gauge theory become classical effects in the gravity region, as is familiar from many other contexts. Let's see, was there, I guess there are many more things of this sort, but we can probably, sorry.
The parameter stability of quantic potential in the digital theory, what does it correspond to in the French
setup? You mean this alpha? So your question is, what am I changing in the geometry when I'm changing alpha in the gauge theory? That is the question.
How do you generate alpha in the brain?
Yeah, yeah, okay, that's the same question. So, so here, so you see, in order to generate this M, so I'm starting with the magnetic brain configuration. In order to generate M, I'm moving the defect brain over here to some non-zero value of this V. And in order to generate alpha, I'm then further rotating it like that. So that's what is written here. Okay, so this angle basically is what governs this alpha.
How is that known?
How do I know this?
Yeah.
It's a, there's a story I can tell you if you want, but I mean, as I suspected, it's already free, so I probably should do it in private. I mean, basically, you can just compare the energetics of various modes here to the gauge theory.
Well, let's see, so I think I said this here. So let me summarize and stop. So there are two main points that I was trying to make here. One is a purely gauge theory point, and that is that you can, by deforming N equal one supersymmetric QCD a little bit, generate a large number of non-supersymmetric vacua that can be long-lived just by tuning parameters in the superpotential. And when you move in and out of various regions of parameter space, some of these states, like the one that we were discussing earlier, become unstable and disappear. Some other ones remain. It's a pretty rich structure, which is realized in a theory with very few parameters here. And of course, you could ask what happens if I don't stop at the quartic superpotential. After all, if this N equal one supersymmetric QCD is thought of as some kind of effective field theory of something at the Planck scale, it could have higher order superpotentials as well. And the number of these metastable states grows very rapidly with the order of the superpotential. But let me not say too much about that. And the second point I wanted to make in this talk is that this whole gauge theory story is very, very natural in string theory, and
Not only that, but at least when you become comfortable with these brain pictures, it provides a, I would say, much simpler way of analyzing for the structure of these non-supersymmetric ground states than the actual gauge theory problem. And of course, in addition to that, the brain picture can be used to perform a quantitative analysis, not just drawing pictures, but calculating masses, lifetimes, etc. But in a regime of parameter space where the gauge theory picture is not valid. Just like when you do gravity on ADS5 process 5, you're doing calculation in a regime in which n equals 4 supra-Engels perturbation theory is not valid. And I think phenomenological applications, serious ones, will have to wait until there is some serious data. But I certainly have nothing to say about them here. So thank you.
Yeah. So some things that you said you will not mention, but is there an interpretation of coefficients if I deform by a higher
in the brain?
Right, in the brain construction, and then related to Jean-Marc question, how do you know that you are turning only, you know, by this field by phi square, or you do a very detailed energetics to make sure?
Yeah, so you know, so for the second question, you know, I'm happy to discuss it, but I don't think there's a point for us to do it right now. As far as these higher terms, I think it's possible to generate them, but there are some issues or constraints on what you can generate and what you cannot generate that have not been fully analyzed. It's related to a question, an issue that was actually mentioned in the original papers and all of this 10 years ago, and it still hasn't been clarified, which is, so superficially it looks like what I'm about to say doesn't have much to do with this, but it actually turned out to be essentially the same issue. In the studies of n equal 1 supersymmetric QCD and Zeiberg duality in gauge theory, there is an interesting generalization of Zeiberg duality to systems which have an adjoint with a polynomial superpotential. And so you could ask, how do you get that from brains? And a proposal for that was made at that time, in 97. And the proposal had to do with stacking up a lot of NS brains instead of the one that we have here. But there are some issues with this. There are some questions that need to be understood. And there hasn't really been a lot of work on those issues. So once that is clarified, I think questions about what you ask can be answered as well.
But in principle, it might be possible to generate this higher order terms by introducing more fields with a simpler superpotential.
Yes. But the question is, can you get that from brains?
Right.
The
thing is, maybe I need the additional brains.
Yes. So. It's indeed not clear. But you know, regarding these questions like how do you know it's quadratic, even without doing any detailed calculation, it should be, I mean, for example, suppose you were confused whether this angle that I introduced there with the brains correspond to a quadratic or a 100th order superpotential. You could easily resolve this confusion by writing in the field theory, the classical field theory, the F term conditions for a W, which is Q tilde Q plus Q tilde Q to the power 100, looking at the solutions of the F term equations and comparing them to the vacuum structure of the brain configuration, which I wrote here. Right? All you can do with the brains as you introduce these two deformations, V2 and theta, is what I drew here. Is you can take the brain, which all sat on top of each other originally, and as you move the... Well, imagine that you have here this triangle that is drawn here, and imagine that you're sort of smoothly making this triangle smaller and smaller. Right? So the first question is, if it's like this, what does this correspond to? And then what happens as you deform it? And whatever your story is, it will, the sort of zeroth order constraint is that it should have the same number of vacuum, right? Even before you ask detailed questions like how does this parameter map to that parameter. And what will fail if you try to, if you try the conjecture that it's not q tilde q squared but q tilde q to the 100 is that. The field theory problem with the QP tilde to the 100 would have just much more, many more vacuum. Now, if you want to know exactly this problem, you need, of course, a little bit more than that. But it's not difficult. It's, if you think about it for 10 minutes, you'll understand it yourself.
If I understood, when you were doing the gauge theory part, you introduced a couple of parameters.
Yes.
For breaking supersymmetry, but in order to carry out the analysis, you had to assume that certain combinations were small. So the question is then, related, I think, to Jamie's question, in the brain picture, what's the analog of that smallness?
Yeah, that's actually interesting.
Could you use the brain picture to go beyond it?
Yes. So there's actually some of. So the general situation is the following in this game. You are given some vacuum of string theory which has some brains in it. And this vacuum of string theory has all sorts of free parameters, G-string, geometric parameters of the brain configuration, etc. In some very limited region in parameter space, the problem just mathematically reduces to the gauge theory problem. And there, all these pictures of the brains I drew don't buy you anything. Just like ADS5 process 5 really doesn't buy you anything if RADS over L string is 10 to the minus 100. Okay. The brain picture, of course, has the feature that you can tune these parameters and leave the regime in which the gauge theory discussion is valid. And it gives you a much larger space of parameters. And so the situation is that in the brain discussion, there are a lot of questions that are easier to analyze than the corresponding questions in field theory, but in a regime which is just not described by field theory. It's not that the brain picture solves for you problems that if you were smarter, you would have solved in field theory directly. It solves a sort of different problem. So for example, in the original ISS model, I believe even as we speak, nobody knows whether if you take supersymmetric QCD with NF equals to NC and turn on a small mass for the quarks, there is or there isn't a metastable state. Whereas in the brain picture, it's a no-brainer. You can prove without spending 3 minutes on it that there is, and you know. But again, it's not that the people that were doing or thinking about this problem in gauge theory were not imaginative enough. It's that in this other regime in the parameters, there is a regime of the brain configuration with NF equals to NC that they drew here, where the problem just reduces it to gauge theory. And in that regime, the brain construction doesn't buy you anything. You have to just solve the field theory problem one way or another. But what it does tell you is that in that system, you can change the parameters, you know, these geometric parameters that it's talking about, and go get to a regime in which there definitely is a stable state for NF equals to NC. That's one example. So finally, the answer to your question is that these conditions are relevant in the gauge theory regime. They are just not relevant in the string theory regime. So by string theory regime, I mean, by definition, a regime in which all these parameters, so you know, what parameters does this story have? This is a distance scale, this is a distance scale. The length of these default brains are distance scales. There is G-string. These are the parameters that go into this. So the cleanest version of what I said here is if all the distances that I just mentioned are large in string units, all of them, then the string theory problem becomes easy. And in that regime, really the only constraint that you need to satisfy for all this to work is that G string is very small. But that regime is very, very far from the gauge theory regime, as you can see from here. For example, the mass is equal to the string tension times this length scale. So if the this V2 is large in string units, this mass is very large in string units. And of course, nobody claims that if you take this brain configuration and introduce to the quarks a mass which is very large in string units, you can still study the system in terms of the low energy gauge theory. That is just not true. In that regime, you should be studying the full string problem. And so that's an example of how there is a completely different set of constraints in these different regimes. And this is one of the things I meant concretely when I said that the, when I said at the end there that the brain picture can be used to do quantitative calculations in regimes that are different from the gauge theory regime. After all, you know, if you're going to use something like this for a hidden sector of some supersymmetry breaking theory, who said that this sector should be just the gauge theory, right? We basically know nothing about it.
No, it doesn't need to be. But you did indicate there was a regime of the gauge theory that you couldn't handle by the gauge theory method, but it was still the gauge theory. Would that
be no, what I meant to say, what I've now said in detail. Yeah. That there is, so again, what I meant to say, maybe I didn't say it right. What I meant to say is that in these brain configurations, before you turn on deformations like this M and alpha, the low energy limit of the brain thing is just the gauge theory, at least near the origin of modular space. And then when you turn on M and alpha, they have to be sufficiently small in order for you to be able to use gauge theory. And typically, the strict theory type considerations work outside of that regime. That is what I meant to say. And you know, when it's the gauge theory, it's the gauge theory you have to solve. But you know, this brain picture actually teaches you a lot of other things that I didn't have time to get to. Okay, let me stop here.
More questions? Then let's thank the speaker one more time.